You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And our focus today, our big conversation, is domestic violence through the lens of the pandemic. According to the Blue Shield of California Foundation, 58%, so well over half of Californians, have been impacted by domestic violence. Jackie Marroquin is the director of programs at the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence, and she joins us now to talk about the impact COVID-19 has had on victims of domestic violence and statewide efforts to support survivors. Welcome to the program, Jackie.
Thank you for having me.
So the National Domestic Violence Hotline collected data from March 16th to May 16th, so right there during the peak shutdown at the beginning of the pandemic. And it was found that there was a 9% increase in contacts received, whether they were calls or chats or texts. And the state has shut down in an effort to slow the spread of COVID-19. So how does this affect those who are in a domestic violence situation?
Well, the impact is huge. I mean, it's huge on even, you know, for families where, you know, we have healthy families, where we have families that have, you know, an income coming in, and it's difficult for, you know, for most people. There are stressors that all families are now facing, all communities are now facing because of COVID. Now, if you can imagine a layer, an additional layer of stressors on families when there are issues of power and control, and there are issues of violence and domestic violence in families, and then you add to that the you know the now the stressors, right, of the economy and the fact that survivors and folks are having a tough time finding the relief that they need in order to figure out some of those stressors and alleviate some of those stressors from families. And so you know, one can only imagine what survivors might be going through, especially during these times. You know, in for the last 40 years, the domestic violence field has done a really, really good job of setting up a system that helps families and helps survivors stay physically safe and stay safe from abuse. And here we are in these times with a global pandemic, where folks are being told that the safest thing you can do is stay at home and isolate. Mm. And so isolation is actually one of the tactics of abuse in domestic violence situations, in when there is abuse in families. And so you're adding the stressor of an already violent relationship, a relationship where there's power and control and domination. And you add to that the fact that the only way to stay physically safe or safe from COVID is to isolate.
Wow.
And so it's just a difficult time for survivors, and you just layer on, you know, issues of after issues.
So let's talk then a little about some advocacy done in order to create policy recommendations that eventually led to a package that secures resources for survivors.
That's right. You know, last week, the legislature, or not last week, last month, the legislature approved the 2021 budget.
Huh. And California's.
That, you know, that in California's budget, that's right. And in California's budget, you know, we pre-COVID times, right, before COVID, we were looking at a surplus, and, you know, we were looking at adding funds for prevention work, more long-term, you know, long-term prevention work across the state. And all of a sudden, here we are facing a $54 billion budget shortfall. And so part of what we were able to do, and we were grateful to the legislature and the governor for having included this, included, you know, $5 million in prevention funding that we secured back in 2019, but that we were at risk of actually losing in this particular, in the 2020-21 budget. You know, we were able to secure $20.6 million for shelter-based programs in California, so that is staying steady, because we know that local programs are, in fact, the lifeline for many survivors, survivors who are not calling law enforcement, survivors who are not wanting to separate from the person who is causing them harm, and who don't want to separate their families, particularly when leaving a violent situation means that you can, you know, you might not even find a place to go to at this point in time. And so, you know, these are the safety nets that survivors, even in the best of times, right, in terms of budgetary times, without a pandemic, these are lifelines and safety nets that survivors absolutely need. And the worst thing that could have happened is for all of this lifeline or these safety net programs, including local domestic violence programs, to actually lose that funding. Another thing that we were able to secure was we worked with the California Office of Emergency Services and the Governor's Office and the First Partners Office to secure $3 million that we were able to funnel through directly to local programs.
Oh, good.
So what we saw was the difference between, you know, I think when the stay-at-home orders first came into play, I think just like everybody else, right? Everybody was trying to figure out just what are we going to do now? Specifically for survivors, survivors had a really tough time trying to figure out, you know, what are your next steps? Here we are in a global pandemic. Folks are losing their jobs. Folks, you know, are close to losing their housing. And in those moments, survivors, anecdotally, survivors were saying, well, I'm not moving. I'm not leaving from here. We can't leave. It would be much more dangerous for a survivor to leave their home, go to a shelter, or to go somewhere else where they could be exposed to COVID.
Yeah.
And so survivors wanted to stay home. And we saw a decrease in the number of calls to domestic violence hotlines and to the National DV hotline at the very beginning of the pandemic. What we have seen now is that the calls have actually increased for support because survivors are in fact being very isolated. You know, we have stories from local programs that say, you know, there's survivors who are literally just trying to get into, you know, their closets to have just a couple of minutes to be able to speak to someone who can offer them some, you know, support, or taking a quick walk with, you know, around the block to be able to contact for support. And, you know, we did a really, really, really good job of letting folks know that domestic violence organizations were still open and still providing services.
You're still there for them. Yeah.
Still here, still providing all those services.
Jackie, just really briefly, I just want to ask you about a partnership with Airbnb so that you can have some more of that shelter you were talking about. If you could wrap that up in just, you know, like 30 seconds.
Sure. Yeah. Airbnb, we were so grateful to receive funding from Airbnb to be able to provide housing for survivors. Housing is the number one issue and a number one barrier for many survivors to be able to leave a violent situation. And so Airbnb very generously provided a funding for survivors to be able to find housing anywhere they are. So it's not necessarily Airbnb specific locations where survivors can go, but it's wherever they are and whatever housing is available, and we'll be able through local programs to provide that kind of support to survivors, which is so needed right now.
Jackie, I want to thank you for being here. And I do study Spanish. I'm moderate at best, I guess, intermediate.
I know. I heard you in the Marroquín.
So that I wanted to just underscore that you did tell our producer, Cynthia, that that's how you pronounce it. So I wanted to do my best. So Jackie Marroquín is the director of programs at the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence. Thank you. Thank you for your insight on this today. I think that's really an important element.
Muchísimas gracias. Take care.
All right. Hasta luego.
Hasta luego.
In Sacramento, the Family Justice Center offers a variety of resources to those who are suffering through domestic violence, elder and child abuse. It was founded in 2016, and its CEO, Faith Whitmore, joins us to talk about it. And Faith, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having all these good people and good information at a time like this.
Well, your focus is pretty broad. It's not just women or kids or grandma who's being abused. It's all of them.
Right. We serve victims of domestic violence, elder abuse, human trafficking, sexual assault, and child abuse. But primarily our victims who are coming in right now are domestic violence and elder abuse. Mm. And interestingly enough, tied with all this, elder abuse has increased significantly during this time as well.
So as Jackie was mentioning, there is a pandemic going on, and that drastically changes the situation for everyone. You could call it the pandemic effect, I guess, when it comes to the people who use your services. And you are keeping statistics on this. What are you seeing?
Well, since we are comparing this year to last year, we've had an increase of 73% of people coming in. Our services are free walk-in basis. And we have seen an increase of 93% of people seeking restraining orders. So we are
almost a doubling.
Almost a doubling. That's right. And they continue to go up. And I think what Jackie said, and also what Dennis said, is that this is increasing. We're not seeing a decrease. And we are also preparing ourselves for what happens when we open even more than we are right now. Our sense is that people who can maintain some safety in their own homes are doing that. But when it finally gets to be too much, they reach out to us or other services. And so we are also seeing a significant increase in the severity of physicality. Mm. The increase in strangulation, for example, has gone up tremendously. And that's very, very concerning to us as well.
Do you think that dip that Jackie mentioned in the beginning had to do with the fact that everyone was on extreme lockdown and there just wasn't a chance to communicate in any way?
Right. I think that's true. And I think we didn't expect it to go on this long. So I think people were holding on as long as they could. But when we don't know when this is ever going to end, people just say, I can't do it anymore. I've got to get help.
And your services are still there, but slightly limited. Is that right?
Actually, we are serving everybody who comes in. We have yet to turn anybody away. What has impacted us is that we can't have volunteers in the center. We no longer have our interns from the Sac State University, for instance, in social work and the law schools. We have attorneys on staff, but we can't have the legal interns because of, you know, safety issues.
Yeah.
And social distancing. We need to spread everybody apart as much as possible.
Faith, you mentioned the increase in elder abuse and domestic abuse, but you're not seeing that increase when it comes to children. And I'm wondering what it is that you think is behind that.
Well, I think probably what Melissa will say and what Jackie said as well is that the children that we see are the collateral damage, if you will, of the domestic abuse situations. We do report to CPS when we have families come in.
Child Protective Services.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you. Where we're concerned about the children. So we do continue to report because our experience with Child Protective Services is they have a lot to offer to these families. There's a lot of support. Their mission is not just to take children out of the home. So we are very grateful for our partnership with them.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the concerns you have, because we are in a pandemic, with people that come to the center for help? What are some of the biggest struggles?
Well, one of the struggles, as Jackie mentioned, is housing, safe shelter. The shelters are full in our community. We're paying for hotel and motel stays, which we did not budget for, but we think it's so critical that these people have a safe place to go. They no longer can go to families' homes or friends' homes. Due to COVID. And so housing is absolutely critical.
Do you have grants for that, or it's just completely out of pocket? Since it wasn't in the budget, how are you doing that? How are you pulling that off?
Taking it out of what contributions we do have. We have a small little grant that has covered some of it, but not all of it.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the other services that you offer in addition to providing that much needed shelter?
So we have case management, crisis management. We have attorneys on staff who help with restraining order petitions. And as I said, that's almost doubled.
Yeah.
And we have counseling and, you know, what we try to do, it's a one-stop center for these victims. And so they come in and we talk to them, figure out what it is that they need, and then we will help navigate them from a place of danger to a place of safety. So it can be anything from applying for first-time housing vouchers, food, clothing, whatever it is, we will go out and find that on their behalf.
And we want to mention that all of the services that you're hearing about today on Cap Radio will be available on the Cap Radio website at capradio.org/insight. So if there's something that you hear that you think this is for me or this is for my neighbor or a friend of mine, by all means, head to capradio.org/insight to get that much needed information. Family Justice Center CEO Faith Whitmore, thank you for that. Really, those eye-opening statistics. The near doubling of restraining orders is the one that really stood out for me.
Thank you, Randall.
Thank you, Faith. All right, still ahead, new data from Sacramento County's Child Protective Services. What does it show regarding the number of reports of abuse now that kids are learning from home? Also, how survivors of sexual assault are using their experiences to help change the criminal justice system as calls are made to defund the police. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday. I'm Randall White, and we're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Children were distance learning this past spring, and in most cases will continue down that same path as classes start up again in the coming weeks. This means students who are suffering from physical abuse.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At home, aren't coming into contact with teachers who often can alert authorities to suspicions of child abuse. One system put in place to keep kids safe is Child Protective Services, and how people view this county department varies depending on a variety of factors. Melissa Lloyd is the deputy director of Sacramento County's CPS and joins us now to help us understand better how this county service fits into the broader picture of abuse. And Melissa, good to see you again.
Thank you, Randall.
So I want to start with some data that your department has collected over the past few months, pandemic period data, and compare that with the same period last year. What have you learned?
Sure. Thank you so much. I do appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. What we have looked at is in regard to the timeline for COVID. We have put together some data, and we're consistently looking at our data all the time to compare and also just determine where our resources need to be placed.
What's working, what's not working, all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So we took quarter two of 2019, which is April, May, and June of the calendar year, and we did some comparisons to 2020, April, May, and June. And so we have had overall to our child abuse and neglect hotline, we've had a 43% decrease of calls to the hotline. On average, pre-COVID, we were averaging about 5,000 calls, 4,500 to 5,000 calls a month. All of those calls that come in don't specifically, they're not specifically for a concern about a child or a family. So we look at, in regard to the calls that do come in specific to child neglect and abuse, we had a 35% decrease in those calls. So overall calls, 43%, but specific to child abuse and neglect, we've had a 35% decrease. However,
so wait, Melissa, I just want to stop you there really fast. So sometimes people just call and, you know, they think they're calling the county for something entirely different, and they end up with your department.
Correct.
But that's still counted as a call. And so,
yes.
So what you're saying is, when you filter all of those out and it's really just calls that have to do with Child Protective Services, you've seen a 35% drop from spring of 2019 to spring of this year during the pandemic.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. We do receive a number of calls where our team at the hotline navigates community members to where they need to be.
To where they need to go, because somehow they just ended up at the wrong department. So,
correct. Uh-huh. And out of the calls that are where the concerns are for child neglect or child abuse, we have seen a 17% increase in the matters that have been opened for an investigation.
Oh, mm-hmm. So the calls that are coming in, while there's fewer of them, a higher percentage of those are deemed worthy of opening a case.
Correct.
Uh-huh.
Correct. In regard to domestic violence, we do capture data as well for our reports opened for investigations involving domestic violence. What we found is that in 2019, 19% of the calls that came in were investigated for domestic violence. And in 2020, 25% were investigated. But the important thing to remember there is that while the percentage of investigations with domestic violence as a risk factor has gone up, mm-hmm. overall, the number has reduced.
Melissa, how would domestic violence cases end up at CPS?
So we will get Faith Whitmore from Family Justice Center, who I was very happy to see that you had on this call today, shared that they will report Family Justice Center. We will get reports from a variety of people in the community. We will get calls from law enforcement. We will get calls from community providers such as Family Justice Center, but other community providers, because Sacramento is very rich in resources. And so there's calls of folks that are working with individuals in the community. And if there is a concern about child neglect or abuse, those calls come to us from professionals in the community. We also get calls from relatives and from neighbors and people in the community that have a concern that a child is being harmed or maybe harmed in some way.
Where are you seeing this drop, this 35% drop in calls? Are you able to isolate out, we're not getting as many calls from teachers, because that's the speculation right there.
It is. And that is true across the state of California as well as across the nation. But with kids being out of school, a high percentage of our calls do come from school personnel. In addition, we also know that kids are, and this is a smaller percentage, but we also know that kids aren't seeing medical professionals as often for the preventive care. So oftentimes there's kids where their physician may call in. But overall, school personnel and a lot of the services, as we all know, during this time of COVID, a lot of families who are participating in certain services, they've gone to virtual. Mm-hmm. And so some of children and youth in the community, as well as parents that maybe previously were getting some type of community service, because we are isolated more in our homes and we're not out and about in the community, that also means we're not out doing certain, if there was a connection like to a recreation center or a counseling center or something of that nature, everything is turning virtual.
Right.
And so again, although much smaller than the reports that would come in from school personnel, there's also some other community providers that don't have as much contact mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. kids and families that they once did.
Melissa, our previous guests were discussing, some of the different services they provide and helping to find shelter and that sort of thing. How does CPS fit into that when it comes to children who are being abused? What happens when CPS is alerted? What happens?
So when we are first alerted, we will take the call, and we've got a team of hotline workers who work 24/7. Our hotline is a 24/7 operation. And our hotline workers do an assessment over the phone when they receive the call. At that time, they are very quickly determining what the next step will be. There's many calls that we get that don't rise to the criteria where we would open an investigation. However, it doesn't stop us from making some links to community services at that point. So we will do that at the hotline for circumstances that rise to an investigation. An investigation is created, and that goes to our field team. And we've got across the county teams of social workers who go out and do investigations. And as they're working through their investigation, we are always looking at, first and foremost, child safety. What is currently occurring with this family, mm-hmm. with this child specifically? And we look for, is there a way to, we want to get that child to safety right away. That does not mean that it goes from investigation right to removal if we find a child unsafe. Right. Mm-hmm. What we do is we engage with the parents to seek out, who are your current supports? Who can we call to help? What have you tried? What is going on? We're not just assessing that child or that youth. We're assessing the parents.
The whole network.
What is current? The whole family. And then we really delve into, how can we help bring safety to this child, which means bringing safety to the family.
Melissa, briefly.
So how do we do that?
Briefly, mm-hmm. because we're in this weird period right now where children are not where they're normally supposed to be and that sort of thing. What can neighbors, family members, friends do? What should they be looking for? And when does it come to a point that they should contact you? And if I know that's a lot, but if you could do that in about a minute, that would be great.
Sure. So I will say, first and foremost, thank you for asking. We want community to be looking out for community. And that is the number one thing that will help all of us through this time. If there is a direct concern that a child is being harmed, absolutely call our hotline, which is 916-875-KIDS, 916-875-5437. That is the hotline. However, we always want to promote, and this is for everyone, uh-huh. COVID or no COVID, look out for one another. Mm. Seek out resources. Help your neighbor. Lend a helping hand. There may be something that you see. It may not be indicative that child is being abused, but that the family is going through stress. Things are so different for all of us, and we all need support in different ways. And especially for families that are more vulnerable, they really could use a helping hand and someone to say, how can I help, versus jumping to, I think you're harming your child.
Oh, right. But good. Good.
Most people know when they see a child who is actually being harmed.
Yeah. Good suggestions. Melissa Lloyd, Deputy Director of Sacramento County's Child Protective Services, or CPS. Thank you for that perspective this morning, which was so important.
Thank you.
Cap Radio's Sam Akiola is telling stories about the intersections of race, police violence, and sexual assault as demonstrators across the U.S. call for a shift in funding away from law enforcement and towards social services. Survivors are joining the fray and calling for more trauma-informed services. You may have heard the first part of her three-part series on this topic earlier today during Morning Edition, and Sammy joins us now to discuss the series and what she's found during her reporting process. Sammy, it's always a pleasure to see you.
Good morning, Randall. Thanks for having me.
And I want to mention that the services that we have discussed earlier in the program are also available and linked on your current stories, your series, so that people can either go to capradio.org/insight or just go to capradio.org and your story is featured right there. So,
That's right. We have a resource page as well.
Sammy, you are a healthcare reporter. How did you come to covering this issue?
This goes way back for us. We got a phone call back in 2019 from a listener who was a survivor of sexual assault, who had taken her case to local police and just felt really ostracized and dismissed and disappointed by her treatment, by the officers, and by the fact that her case didn't really move forward. It didn't get sent to prosecutors, and she felt that she wasn't believed and that she wasn't being taken seriously. Mm. And, you know, as a reporter, I immediately felt that that's disturbing and not what you would want,
right?
Not what you would want if you were looking for help. And so I started asking around to experts and other survivors and activists, and I found that it's a somewhat pervasive issue. Now, obviously, not everyone's experience is the same. You know, some people may go to law enforcement and it may go great, but we started just collecting stories from a handful of survivors who had what they considered a negative experience. And mm-hmm. we ended up forming a cohort, is what we're calling it. And this is part of our community engagement work, which Jessica Maria Ross at Cap Radio has been helping with. And we basically started checking in with survivors, having these gatherings once a month to learn just what it's like to be in their shoes and how this reporting process, when you go to tell your story to law enforcement, how it affects your healing in the long term. Mm-hmm. And we've learned that if you've already been through trauma, going to the police and having a negative experience can be just another trauma on top of
that. An additional traumatic experience, right. What are your survivors telling you in this cohort? What are you hearing?
So it's really a range of things. Some people feel just awkward when they have to go into a police station and sit under the fluorescent lights and talk about these graphic details about themselves. Some people felt like the officers didn't understand the non-consensual nature of the event. I mean, sometimes this happens on a date or it's in your home or it's someone that you know, and suddenly it becomes something that's not consensual. And you know, some women they feel officers aren't understanding that. And officers will also ask them questions about what they were wearing or what they had to drink that night. And it can really, you know, cause shame or guilt or frustration.
Yeah. Was it something I did? You know, is what starts going through your head. Yeah.
It can really cause people to self-doubt and question, you know, even their self-worth. Mm-hmm. It's also very difficult for survivors to remember all of the details in order because of the way that trauma affects the brain. It's very chaotic and you have this sort of fight or flight response. And so law enforcement needs to be really careful about not drilling people for information. Obviously they need to gather facts, but there is a more trauma-informed way to do those interviews. And a lot of the survivors I talked to felt very put off by the way they were spoken to. So here is a little montage of a handful of survivors that had bad experiences.
It was as if it was my fault.
They didn't take me seriously.
It was an interrogation.
It was just a very, very scripted, very just like non-concerned, just get the paperwork done type interview.
I was just shut down or ignored or made to feel like you're not important.
Mm. So I want to tie this into the current moment. So when we started this series, we were thinking, okay, well, how can police do this better? And then as we moved into George Floyd demonstrations and the defund the police movement, we started to hear, should police be doing this at all? And I talked to this woman, Dominique Green. She reported her rape to Rockland police last fall. And she, like the survivors you just heard from, felt really uncomfortable. And so when the defund the police protest started, she really wanted to make her voice heard, both as a survivor and as a Black woman.
It's definitely frustrating when people, like all the Facebook moms, saying like, oh, what are you going to do when you defund the police and you need someone there after you've been sexually assaulted? And it's like, well, they aren't there anyways, you know? This needs to be defunded and taken over by somebody else, someone who's trained in this type of situation and setting and knowing how to just be there for somebody and handle it appropriately without making it seem like it's just another case, because it's not. Like, this will affect me for my entire life, and to the cops, it's just another case.
So Sammy, in about 10 seconds, where does it go from here, your reporting?
Yeah, people want to see a different kind of first response. They don't want the initial person they speak to be a law enforcement officer, kind of along the lines of mental health crises. You know, we're hearing mm-hmm. people call for cops to not respond to 911 calls. All right. So there's this idea of what would alternative responses to sexual assault look like, and it could be mental health counselors or victim advocates.
All right. Cap Radio's Sammy Kayola, thank you so much. And a big thank you to Cynthia Lopez, who produced the show. This is Insight. So that's today's deep dive look into one single topic from several different perspectives. Now for an in-depth conversation regarding the news of the day. From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. In just a bit on the show, we'll be looking at the...
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
The issues of domestic violence and sexual assault through the lens of the current pandemic, hearing several voices and perspectives. But first, those who lived through the 1970s and 80s in Sacramento may well remember the name Robbie Waters. He was a big name in city law enforcement and politics, serving on the city's police force for many years, also serving as Sacramento County Sheriff for one term, and as a member of the city council for 16 years. He even ran for mayor one time. Robbie Waters died yesterday at the age of 84. His daughter, Deanna Earle, is kind enough to spend a bit of her morning with us now to share some memories. And this is also recent for you. We really appreciate your willingness to join us this morning, Deanna.
Thank you so much for having me.
Help us understand who your dad was. I've heard him described as a character, in quotes, but that's such a broad term. So I'm hoping that you can narrow it down a bit for us.
Boy, he was a go-getter. He was not afraid of a challenge. He accomplished what he wanted to accomplish, and nobody was going to stop him from doing that. He was an incredible person, pillar in the community, and just a loving husband and father.
There are so many reports over the past 24 hours saying how much he loved Sacramento. Is that how you would characterize him too?
Oh, for sure. You know, my brother made the comment that, you know, born Sacramento all the way through, you know, stayed right here for 84 years. And he was always focused on how he could make it better, what he could do to contribute, to help to make it a better place.
Yeah. Your father was a conservative in the capital of California, but that did not stop him from making friends with leaders in the Democratic Party. And that's not necessarily something that we see a lot of today. How was your dad different in that respect?
You know, I believe he was willing to hear anybody and what they had to say. And he was not going to waver from his, you know, beliefs. However, he was open and willing to at least listen. And if it made sense to him. And I think one of the things was, if it was what his constituents wanted, that's what he did. Mm-hmm. He didn't do necessarily just what Robbie Waters wanted to do. If his constituents wanted him to support and vote a certain way, he would do what his constituents wanted him to do. So it wasn't his show. It was for the people of his area.
Yeah, in his area, his constituents for most of his career were in the Pocket Greenhaven area.
Yes, they were.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So yes. Current Mayor Daryl Steinberg is quoted in the Sacramento Bee as saying, Robbie and I came from different places in the political world, but none of that mattered. I considered him a dear friend. Former Mayor Kevin Johnson says Robbie was a dedicated public servant and the best of our city. I'm better for having known him. He was a mentor and a friend, and I miss him. So how does it feel to you to hear leaders like this describing your dad that way?
It's pretty amazing. You know, it's he did make the impact, not necessarily just on the city as a whole, but on individual people. I guess one of the greatest accomplishments as far as making an impact on people was he actually saved a doctor from Sacramento on a cap-to-cap trip back in Washington, D.C. Dr. Young was choking on a piece of steak, and my dad noticed it and performed the Heimlich maneuver and saved this doctor's life, you know. So it wasn't just with words, it was with actions. And, you know, I think people really love that about him. You know, one of the phone calls we got was Doris Matsui had called a couple days ago to check on him. And, you know, it just, you know, the lifelong friends that he made and the things that he created by being a part of this city was amazing.
And again, highlighting those bipartisan friendships.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. He would be a friend with anybody, but he would also, you know, if he didn't like you, he didn't hide much.
According to KCRA and other sources that I saw, but KCRA had this in 1975 when President Gerald Ford was nearly assassinated at the state capitol by Charles Manson follower Squeaky Fromm. It was your dad who helped apprehend the would-be killer. What do you remember from that incident? Because that's a pretty big slice of American history there.
Sure. Well, I was pretty young then, but, you know, I've seen the pictures and these, you know, of course, we've talked about it through the years and stuff. And now as I'm an adult, it's like, wow, that was really a big deal. You know, right. You know, probably when you're 9 years old, it's probably like, oh, well, whatever, dad arrested somebody. But, you know, once you understand the who that was and how different that could have been, it was pretty remarkable.
I also understand that when your father was sheriff, again, this is from the Sacramento Bee, he's credited with expanding the Sexual Assaults Bureau with the Sheriff's Department. That is the topic of our show as we move forward after your segment. And I'm wondering, was that something that he ever spoke about?
You know, that was nothing I knew about, but it's pretty remarkable because our youngest daughter actually was sexually assaulted 2 years ago at college in Montana. And I did not know that until I saw that in the paper. So, I mean, to have, you know, to know that he implemented that and that my daughter had to go through that and was we brought the justice to her with the courts through that. But that was pretty amazing. And that's, you know, he was a champion. He was a champion for all people. It didn't matter.
Wow. Well, thank you for spending, you know, just a few minutes with us this morning to help share those memories of your dad, Deanna Earle, daughter of former Sacramento City Council member and County Sheriff Robbie Waters, who died yesterday from COVID-19 complications. I do want to quickly note, I imagine this came as a shock. Did you expect COVID-19 to play this kind of a role?
Not at all. You know, he went in for a partial hip replacement when he fell and broke his hip on June 30th. On June 8th, he went to a skilled nursing facility and he told my mom, I don't want to go to a nursing facility. I don't want to get that virus. Mm. And then on the 13th, when he had to go back to the hospital for a hematoma, that's when they discovered, they tested him upon entry and he tested positive for COVID. He had absolutely no signs. They were testing him faithfully, doing his temperature. He had no cough. He had no signs whatsoever. And so we thought that would be on his side and had no pre-existing conditions as far as heart and lungs or anything like that. And so now 15 days later, we are talking about plans to cremate him. And his passing is just, it's unbelievable. We had no idea. We were so shocked.
Oh, Deanna, I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah. And that just underscores that whole pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic period that people go through when they are shedding the virus and are definite. You know, you may not feel like you have it, but by all means, you know, keep yourself from infecting others. So
exactly.
I understand there will be a celebration of life and I wish you the best during that.
Thank you so much.
All right. Deanna Earle again, daughter of former Sacramento City Council member and County Sheriff Robbie Waters. Okay, let's shift to the other part of our show now. And some experts believe we will see a spike in domestic violence crimes as the coronavirus pandemic plays out. A new study done by UC Davis found that domestic violence-related hospital visits increased during the Great Recession that began in 2008. Of those emergency department visits, Black and Native American people were disproportionately affected, but white, Latino, and Asian populations also saw significant increases. Joining us to talk about it is the author of the study, Dennis Reedy. He's an assistant professor in the School of Public Health at Georgia State University. And welcome to you, Dennis.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So this was one of the first studies of its kind, was it not, to look at the relationship between hospital visits for physical abuse in adults and an economic downturn?
Yes, it's one of the first to compare the effect of the economy on hospital visits we have known for a time that financial stress can be a risk factor for domestic violence, including violence against children, partners, elders, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And this was not a small study. You looked at some 53,000 cases?
Correct. In the entire state of California from 2000 to 2015. So quite a large sample.
Mm-hmm. And then narrowing down the window of time where the recession hit and separating those out.
Correct. So we split the period from the year 2000 and through 2007 when that recession hit. And the recession, as you know, lasted until about June of 2009. And so we looked at the differences in emergency department visits and also hospitalizations. And, you know, what we saw and was perhaps most interesting is that we followed the data through 2015. The recession ended around 2009 and 10. And as most people know, we've seen great economic expansion over the last decade. Yet the rates of emergency department visits related to violence continued to grow and were at the height in 2015, when the last year which we had data. Hmm. So even though the economy started to improve, there was still potentially this residual impact.
And you could say residual, but you said they were growing still at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and the nature of the study doesn't allow us to exactly understand why that might be. We do know that as the economy has expanded over this last decade, so has the wealth gap, racially speaking. So I think in 2010 from 2013, we saw the median household wealth for Black, African-American families drop by about 30%, 15% for Hispanic, but that's not the case for white families. And the average income dropped about 10% as a whole for minority families, whereas it only dropped about 1% for white families. So potentially we see, while the economy is getting better, still we see these disparities in the wealth gap getting larger. And therefore, even though the economy may be getting better, the impact of that economic downturn stays with those most at risk.
And then, Dennis, we had this year a sudden sharp drop in the economy brought on by COVID-19. Based on your research over that long period, what do you expect to see moving forward?
Well, I think we're already seeing it. You know, the data is still quite preliminary. We don't have good epidemiological data yet, but we have seen globally even an increase in the number of domestic violence reported cases from police in Australia, France.
I just want to make clear, from police records, not from police.
From police, yeah, yeah. Okay. So the number of calls related to domestic violence incidents since the shutdown in March, April area, okay, has increased in a number of different areas, including France, Australia, Cyprus, and so on. We have also seen that the number of reports to child welfare services has gone down. Mm-hmm. Which is not a good sign. It's kind of paradoxical.
Because the incidents have likely not gone down.
Right. And in fact, they're likely going up. We do know that the number of calls to like parent helplines and domestic violence hotlines is increasing. So it would suggest that what's happening is that there are less opportunities for people to observe the incidents of violence and then Good Samaritans to make contact. You know, a lot of reports come from school,
right?
Administrators, teachers, that kind of thing. And so now with kids not in school, it's likely that those cases won't be reported. And we're seeing an increase in the number of risk factors. Sales and alcohol goes up. Social isolation puts people in close contact with their abusers for extended periods of time.
Right.
It's a perfect storm.
Briefly here, and finally, one of your co-authors, Amy Bonami, is that how you pronounce Amy's last name, of Michigan State, says proactive outreach is especially needed for minoritized people who may be especially isolated, as you just mentioned, experiencing disconnections from services and those sorts of things. What do you make of her statement?
Yeah, I think that's very true. The populations most at risk are least likely, least able to reach out for help themselves. It can put them in danger at times if they try to seek help. So here we need, especially that's true at any point in time, but especially now it's even more difficult to figure out how can we reach these populations safely who are most at risk. Mm-hmm.
All right. Dennis Reedy, an assistant professor in the School of Public Health at Georgia State University. Thank you for crunching that data for us and the research that you did to help shine a light on this.
Thank you very much.
Up next, new data from our current economic downturn brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic showing that anticipated spike in domestic violence calls that we were talking about. We'll hear from a couple of women who can tell us what's being done to protect the most vulnerable. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.